You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 15th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Paul Farmer, Chair of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School, co-founder of Partners in Health. On his book, Fever, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History. Meanwhile, Bill Barr, bye-bye. Exit stage right to a sinecure, I'm sure. Joe Biden wins the Electoral College and the presidency again. U.S. passes 300,000 coronavirus deaths. It's going to get worse. And the Gang of Four-ish releases their coronavirus relief details. Two separate bills. Negotiations, meanwhile, wrapping up on a budget deal to last through fiscal 2021. Oddly, before we find out if the Democrats will control the Senate in 3 weeks. Senate Democrats look for answers on why we face a possible vaccine shortage. And congratulations, your Goldman Sachs quota has been fulfilled on the Biden transition team and surpassed. Anonymous sources tell the Washington Post that five agencies, including DHS, state, and the NIH, have now been hacked. Lastly, Trump raising money for his own PAC while pretending to do so for the Republican Georgian runoffs. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. We're here in New York just waiting for a massive storm. Joining me today, as always, Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma. Are you getting ready for this nor'easter that's supposedly coming?
Hello, Sam. And I'm a little bit excited. I mean, I like when New York is all snowy and, you know, old movie-esque, Miracle on 34th Street. Maybe I'll give that a watch. And plus, I just have to walk to work, so I don't have to drive.
It is nice. It is New York, when it gets this type of snow, if we get it, foot feels like it could be 100 years ago. Right. So it's pretty cool, but
I do feel for people who have to drive in this weather. Oh my God.
It's not happening.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen if this storm hits in the way that it's supposed to. Folks, thanks for joining us. That last story about, Donald Trump raising money off the Georgia election is pretty funny.
I love it.
We will see. I saw a report that said something like close to 20,000 voters have already voted in early voting, I believe. Who did not even vote in the general election.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, we're seeing polling and it's immensely tight with Ossoff leading by 1 point. And I think Warnock leading by 1.5 points, something like that in the 538 average. But who's to know? I mean, we saw that
that's margin of error.
Margin of error, exactly. And sometimes that trends towards Republicans, not to be a Debbie Downer. But that means just get out and vote. If you're trending towards blue or if you know people in Georgia, tell them to vote.
Meanwhile, there was another election, and we will get to Bill Barr leaving. I mean, this is it really is just so he could get, I think, an early start on whitewashing his brand in the context of having served as Donald Trump's lackey. We will talk about that later. But the other when we talk about election, the other election that took place yesterday was the Electoral College met around the country and in their respective states and voted consistent with the way that their states or the population of their states basically suggested that they vote. That's the way our Electoral College works. And they elected Joe Biden president. Now, what do you do if you are committed? You know, they say that, it's almost impossible to change a person's mind if their job depends on it.
Yes.
Well, Newsmax is one of those people, and they've got a little bit of a dilemma because their business model is very much tied into the idea that Joe Biden is not the president. And so how are they going to walk that tightrope after the Electoral College has essentially validated the claims of everyone else that Joe Biden had been elected president?
Maybe they'll just say "not my president" over and over again on their broadcast.
Well, let's see.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Stinchfield. So today, the Electoral College voted, which means Newsmax will officially call Joe Biden the president-elect. Okay, but make no mistake. Cooks. With legal challenges still out there, Newsmax still has not called this race. So how did we get to this disastrous position? I blame China and Democrats' exploitation of the Chinese virus. I'll break that down for you in just a moment. And Attorney General Bill Barr resigns his post today. Sadly, he turned out to be a huge disappointment as he kept the Hunter Biden investigations a secret, quote, to not influence the election. But by keeping it a secret, he did just that. Former Trump advisor Sebastian Gorka is here to weigh in. Plus, the Trump campaign's Mark Lauder will discuss with us the president's path forward and the best legal options at his disposal.
What a cavalcade. So now here's the question. If the Electoral College doesn't do it, what is it? Is it going to be like, as long as there's absolutely no lawsuits? I mean, how are they going to walk this tightrope?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they have a long 4 years ahead of them. And by the way, Stinchfield sounds like it sounds like a town in Indiana that like might be the subject of some sort of teen drama. But I digress. My favorite part was when he just said, "I blame China." More on that later.
It's like, of course,
as if this is something new. They're always going to blame China. And as you know, Xi Jinping installed Joe Biden personally. He was quite involved here. And that's why he can't be actually officially declared president. I mean, maybe they will pretend for the next years to come that Biden was installed by some foreign power and they're never going to fully acknowledge it. I think that's the only route that they can go down at this point.
Yeah, I don't think that necessarily hurts Biden that much. And we should also say that Stinchfield was on that NRA TV with Dan Bongino. And there's inevitably probably some a little bit of professional jealousy.
Certainly.
Bongino is
Skyrocketing.
He's skyrocketing. He's figured out the Facebook algorithm, apparently. But I'm just curious as to what's going to be if the Electoral College is not the inciting event. Like at one point, they're going to have to are they just going to pretend like, oh, we haven't called the race? Or are they going to call the race? Like, I guess the inauguration would be the next opportunity.
They'll never officially call it because they feel like Trump is still president. This is the facts over feelings crowd that always says the left is way too emotional. And yet there are facts right in front of their face that they continue to deny because it hurts their emotions.
Also, Stinchfield is off message. Trump tweeted this out. The only thing secure about our 2020 election was that it was virtually impenetrable by foreign powers. So,
So then how is China involved here? I don't know. Seems to be a little bit of a mismatch.
This is going to be pretty confusing, I think, for a while. And now it's possible if Biden runs for re-election in 2024, then they will call the race the 2020 race for Biden and keep the 2024 one up in air. It could be conceivable that he wins two terms in a row and they still haven't called the race for him.
I don't know if I see that.
I mean, I'm just throwing out about potential Biden scenarios out there. All right. Well, in just a moment, we're going to have Dr. Paul Farmer on the program. In the meantime, obviously, always things are a little hectic these days, certainly in my life, and they're just generally hectic. So how do you get time to sit down, learn some stuff? Well, my recommendation, an app called Blinkist. Blinkist is for anyone who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. What it does, it takes the key insights and ideas from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 different categories, and it puts them together in either 15 minutes worth of text or 15 minutes worth of audio explainers, or what they call blinks. So you use the blinks to get to a topic quickly. You get the key takeaways. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcast creators to blink those for you too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist. And look, here's the key. There's a lot of books, we've talked about this in the past, where I don't want to read, you know, I mean, particularly like I try and, you know, get some, you know, how can I be more charming, more appealing to people and friendly? And so like those type of books, like, you know, Win Friends, Influence People type of thing, I don't want to read the prose.
Yeah.
I just want the, I want
the information.
I want the information. And exactly. And something like Blinkist is great for that. Like I did that with all the Tim Ferriss books where, you know, 80-20 type of situation where like 4-hour work week. Yeah, I want to work 4 hours a week. I mean, we end up doing the show 3 hours a day, so it's virtually impossible. Right. But nevertheless, using Blinkist is one of the best ways of getting that information. You can also use Blinkist Shortcast to quickly catch up on podcast episodes I've missed. And yeah, it would be nice if they did it for ours because I talk so slowly. I don't know how people get through it at all. and, you know, for books, Why We Sleep. That was not a book I was going to read the whole thing, but I'm like, I'd like to know because then I get more anxious about why I'm not sleeping and then I can't fall asleep.
Yeah.
But I've read a couple of them that way, or I should say, you know, use the blinks. Blow Up by Rachel Maddow. Want to see what that was about. Didn't necessarily want to read the whole book. Sorry. But it was very helpful to understand that. Future of Capitalism by Paul Collier. You can check out. They have so many titles across like nonfiction stuff that are both like how to and stuff like that, but also history.
More interesting at dinner parties when you eventually go to them again.
Exactly.
Right.
Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. Start your free 7-day trial. Get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/majority report. Get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. And lastly, it's easy to get caught up in the holiday craze. Easy to worry about going to a doctor's office and missing And basically keeping up with your health. When you need to see a doctor, it feels very difficult. Well, thanks to PlushCare, you can see a doctor right away, whether at home or on the go. PlushCare provides virtual doctor appointments through your smartphone or computer. Just pick a time that works for you. Book an appointment right online. With PlushCare, you can be diagnosed, treated, and even have a prescription sent to your pharmacy of choice within minutes. PlushCare accepts most major insurance carriers and is available in all 50 states. The doctors are there to help by discussing treatment options and providing prescriptions as needed. If you're having difficulty managing your emotions, PlushCare doctors are also available to help. You can schedule an appointment today to discuss your treatment options. PlushCare makes it easier for you than ever to take care of yourself inside and out. Start with your membership today. Go to PlushCare.com/majority. Start a 30-day free trial. That's PlushCare, PlushCare.com/majority for a 30-day free trial, PlushCare.com/majority. Okay, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program the chair of global health and social medicine at Harvard University and a founding director of Partners in Health. He is a recipient of the Public Welfare Medal from the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Paul Farmer, author of his latest Fever Feuds and Diamonds, Ebola and the Ravages of History. It is a real pleasure to welcome you to the program. Dr. Farmer, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to mention that you were the Cole Katronis, University Professor and Chair of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard University, but I was afraid I couldn't pronounce it. So I want to give you a crack at it.
You know, it's phonetic. It's a lovely couple who gave the award, and their name is pronounced Cole Katronis, like phonetically.
Okay, well, fantastic. Thank you so much for that. And I want to start, before I get into your book, with, and I think this is going to address some of the topics in your book, but social medicine. Forgive me being so rudimentary, but what does that mean?
Well, you know, in the book, I called it a regrettably obscure branch of the profession, which is a line I lifted out of Tolkien.
That's funny. Well, so
I read that in fifth grade, and you know, it stuck with. I like then memorized the whole damn trilogy. How's that for nerdy? Social medicine.
The Hobbit's is usually the one people read, but the whole.
Oh no, Hobbit's for wimps. Hobbit's for wimps. Social medicine used to be a big deal in the 19th century when people were, you know, acknowledging the impact of social disparities, racism, rapid urbanization, the usual, on health and well-being, and particularly of poor people. And, you know, it kind of got obscurer as the promise of biomedicine exploded in the 20th century. But it still always tries to get at that question, who lives, who dies, how come? And that's kind of how I try to use it in my practice and in my teaching and in this book. How did I do, Sam?
That's very helpful, because I think, you know, that is in many respects a huge portion of your book here, at least, and I think also obviously indicative of your other books as well. Well, let's talk about this. So the book is I guess part ethnography, maybe part history, and then part about social medicine. And let's start with that ethnography. You went to West Africa to help deal with the Ebola epidemic that started there. And tell us a little bit about the genesis of the book. I know that it came from sitting down with folks who had with a couple of people that you dedicated a significant amount of time to, who had survived Ebola, but had their families and their social networks had been devastated by it.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, I would add that I don't think that I really conducted ethnography in the classic sense. You know, there you learn a language. You're, you know, what they even call them field languages in anthropology. And, you know, you spend a couple of years just sitting and learning about people's lives. And I, of course, was invited there as a doctor, not as an anthropologist. So the ethnography, if there is one, was more a critical look at my own peers, the public health people. It's not a very flattering look, I know, but you know, that's really where the ethnography occurred. For the garden variety ethnography, I really relied on the published work of anthropologists and social historians. So it's not a in any snobby anthropology sense a classic ethnography. But hey, you know, that's not why I was there.
Right.
And so I spent, you know, most of my time working on clinical endeavors. But the idea itself for the book, as you point out, came from one of those former patients, Ibrahim, who, to my surprise, asked me to interview him. And that never happens.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Ibrahim's story, because you dedicate a chapter, or I should say two, between Ibrahim and Yobam. And so tell us their stories and how that led you through this journey, I guess, of telling the broader story of Ebola and its the foundations, I guess, of the way that of the response.
You know, the two of them had very different experiences, as you might imagine. One was a 26-year-old without children of his own at the time, and the other was a 37 or 8 year old mom. And both of them just had devastating losses. Ibrahim told me that more than 20 members of his family had died, you know, during or shortly after Ramadan, which is, you know, a month. And, you know, I just sat there, my mouth probably, my jaw on my chest. You know, it's a very unusual thing for an infectious pathogen to take out that many members of a family. And for Yabom, it was a similar story, but she also lost her children and her spouse. And, you know, that's very hard, to hear as even as a clinician. And usually if you're seeing patients, you don't spend, you know, hours, and certainly not years, talking to people about their experience. Maybe we should, but nobody has time for that. So, you know, carving time out to really learn about their stories was important to me. And, you know, I always start at the beginning and say, where were you born and how did you grow up? And that's not the kind of conversation that happens easily in a clinical setting, in a hospital or a Ebola treatment unit, certainly. We didn't have time to really talk about anything. So those conversations unfurled over time after that initial exchange with Ibrahim when he asked me to interview him. When I say, Sam, that that's not something that happens very often, certainly if you work in the United States or in Haiti, patients are going to want to talk. You know, they're going to want to talk to you about their experience. But to have someone ask you to interview him after that kind of experience, that was new for me after 30 years of being a doctor and anthropologist.
Why do you think he wanted you to interview him? Why do you think he wanted to be interviewed, and why do you think he wanted you to interview him?
Well, as chance would have it, I had interviewed the other patients or recovering patients who were present that evening. And I had started this tradition, it became a tradition, of gathering socially with Ebola survivors, which, you know, at the height of the epidemic, there were all kinds of predictions. You know, it was in this rather beaten down hotel called the Mami Yoko, which I kind of made a character in the book. You know, it's advertised as a luxury beachfront hotel, but, you know, I can't say much about the beach, not having had time to frequent it. And I don't know about the luxury part, but we just started having these dinners. And I had learned this in Haiti as a physician, a young physician in Haiti. You know, people with chronic ailments that are life-threatening, you know, they bond over their illness experience. And if we nurses and doctors are lucky, they bond with us too. So this was not a new experience for me in incorporating survivors, those most directly afflicted by whatever kind of problem we were talking about, be it AIDS or tuberculosis, or in this case, Ebola. It was familiar to me, that approach. That's how you learn a lot of things you would never learn. Even clinical matters come to the fore. Hidden clinical matters come to the fore when you start talking with survivors and their experience. So I knew I wanted to do that, but I didn't know I wanted to write a book until after the exchanges with Ibrahim.
And you said two things that I'm curious about. What did you find clinically from talking to those folks, A, and B, why is it surprising to have that many people in a family die of in the context of an infectious disease?
And I didn't answer your other question either. Why did he ask me? Part of it was that he knew that I had interviewed those other patients about their experience, and could have been that. I mean, I'm certainly not going to credit my own wonderful storytelling abilities, but whatever the reason was, you know, I was very grateful that he did. The sort of things that you can uncover are not the clinical matters you can uncover are around the sequelae, as they're called in medicine, of the infection. So if you go back into the medical literature and study these viruses, they're called filoviruses, or used to be, you'll see that they're, you know, in the rare instances in which the experience of people was actually followed up, you'll find that, you know, people had visual loss, blindness, seizures. And in the heat of the epidemic and inside an Ebola treatment unit, it just, everybody was just scrambling to try and keep people alive. Too little attention was paid to what happened after they left the Ebola treatment unit. So those are the sorts of things that make a difference. And in the case of Yabom, the youngish woman who lost her children and spouse and mother and many others, she was one of those people who was facing vision loss, visual loss. And that's readily treated. So those are the kind of reasons that you really want to get to know patients even after they leave your care for their acute disease. I learned a great deal and am still learning a great deal by talking to the survivors, by staying in touch with them, by maintaining relationships with them. Now, why infectious pathogens don't take out whole families, they're not even reliably, they don't even reliably cause the same illness inside a family. And you can see that with COVID-19 as well, right? Some people, particularly elderly people and those with comorbid conditions, do poorly. But you also see sometimes perfectly healthy people, young people, even children die of COVID. So that kind of variability is very characteristic of most infectious pathogens, including those caused by virus, like both COVID-19 and Ebola are. And, you really don't usually see everybody getting the same grievous illness and everybody facing the same risk of dying with any of these pathogens. And that's one of the sort of myths about Ebola, that it always causes severe disease, that it could never cause asymptomatic illness. Those things prove to be false, as with other pathogens. There are rare exceptions, Sam, like rabies. You know, rabies is devastating and usually lethal among everyone. But the great majority of viruses, bacteria, and parasites that cause disease in humans cause a very wide spectrum of disease.
And I want to get to, I mean, you talk about those myths surrounding Ebola in terms of survival too. And obviously a big part of your book is to talk about outcomes, differing outcomes as a function where you are socially and economically. But let me ask you before we move on to that part about it, and I want to talk a little bit about the history, obviously, that the, because you dedicated a huge portion of your book to how you get to a point where the certain sort of where some of the response to Ebola, for instance, and we can also see the parallels with coronavirus are structural. I want to just curious in terms of what did you learn anything in terms of the idea of having survived a pandemic or an epidemic in terms of maybe predicting how A, individuals, but also B, society reacts following a pandemic?
Yeah. You know, there is a huge literature on this, but it's mostly written by historians, right? Because social historians and medical historians, because in the thick of the epidemic, there's enormous confusion and fear. You know, again, those are standard features of being in the middle of an epidemic or a pandemic. And that's well described too. And of course, we all felt that and are feeling it now around COVID-19. But there are also reliably demonstrated social responses beyond fear and confusion. And in what I saw with Ebola was that efforts to contain the disease were trumping efforts to care for the afflicted. Right? And that, of course, was resonant to me because I'd seen it before. I'd seen it across that continent in the post-colonial setting. I knew it was related to a public health paradigm that lessen the value of Black lives. I mean, there's book after book, study after study. I knew that. But I never really had studied it or written about it at great length, as much as it disturbed me to see this control over care paradigm. And the classic example, which you've discussed before, is around AIDS, right? Because to develop an effective suppressive therapy for the leading infectious killer of adults, young adults in the world, and then decree that it was not cost-effective, feasible, sustainable to use in Africa, the most affected continent, was very familiar to us. And we saw it with every other pandemic as well. So the general point that I would make, Sam, is that epidemics and pandemics always reveal a great deal about the social pathologies. So right. Why would you give all the credit to the virus, right? It's the unequal social conditions that determine both risk for the infection and then risk for bad outcomes or good outcomes for some among the afflicted. And that's another staple of everybody who writes about social responses to pandemics or epidemics. You see it again and again.
And this paradigm of control over care, it functions both within the context of within a society, but also, you know, in between, you know, a broader society. So in other words, the, and this is what, and you write, obviously you write about this quite a bit, is heading to West Africa and seeing that the idea is less to provide for the patients who are suffering and more to make sure that this doesn't get outside of West Africa.
There was no question. You know, even if you were only seeing patients, you could sense this, right? But if you were also involved in discussing policy, international or global responses, funding to address, you know, to water the clinical desert, if you were doing that, you got it all day long, that the real priority here is containment. And if there's a second priority, it's to protect healthcare professionals. And there were so few of them already that they couldn't possibly be the primary caregivers for those afflicted. And the primary caregivers were traditional healers and family members, right? So you had the first priority being containment, the second being protect the healthcare professionals. And then the third, if, you know, it was all too rarely a priority at all, was to make sure the afflicted survived. So that's really an inversion of the idealized social contract that we have with physicians and nurses. The idea that we have embraced, and I think it's embraced all over the world, is that the priority is to take care of the patient in front of you. But that was not the story with this epidemic, nor with other epidemics of Ebola or a related pathogen called Marburg, because they happen in Africa where the natives, as they are still called to this day, by the way, the natives are less important than protecting the surrounding world, and particularly the rich white world, the post-colonial world. So that was familiar to me. But this time I tried to, you know, dig deeper into the roots of that paradigm. And by the way, I would say that is not the paradigm that's at play here in the United States around COVID. What we're seeing here is not control over care. We're seeing a kind of containment nihilism where you have the senior administration, the leadership of the central administration of the United States saying, we're not going to do contact tracing. We're not going to be able to control this, you know, or we're only going to do so after we have a vaccine. And of course, that has meant and will continue to mean ongoing loss of life from COVID-19. So either side of those imbalances we need to address, but the ones we see in the post-colonial world are almost always control over care.
Yeah, I want to get into that because I was going to say the administration is the complete inverse, of course, except for the implications of that lack of containment, except for the care, that level of care seems to end outside of their circle. And so the only thing that sort of leaks out of that circle is the lack of containment and then the implications of spill over. But I want to talk about just some of the aspects of, because you talk about the hundreds of years of extraction from this area, starting, you know, with the slave trade, working through commodities like latex, wood, the diamonds, and how does that extraction, or how does that create the structures that inhibit the ability to provide for care and for just a response in for an epidemic?
That ended up being, as you can tell, the real question I wanted to ask is, how do you create a medical desert? And a medical desert is a clinical desert. That is, there are not people to take care of you, who are certainly not those who are well-trained and well-protected, right? But it's also a public health desert, right? So you don't have the surveillance capacity. And to do those things, both the clinical and public health objectives, to meet those objectives, you have to have staff, stuff, space, and systems. So the question becomes, how does extractive colonialism remove the possibility for having the right staff, stuff, space, and systems? And, some people aren't interested in that or don't have the patience for it. And it's certainly not the question we were asking in the middle of the epidemic.
Right.
But it's an important question nonetheless. And, a friend of mine who's now a household figure, Tony Fauci, a mentor of mine, when he read a draft of this last year, he was saying, this book is 5 inches thick, printed out, double space or double sided. And, you spend so much time on the history, and I got that quite a bit. But I came to feel that it was the historical underpinnings of this desiccation and creation of a medical desert that interested me most. And the things that I thought, if you're going to write about people like Ibrahim and Yabom, then you need to understand how they got into these dire straits, ones in which they would lose such a large number of their family members to this disease, which claimed the lives of zero white Americans, as you know, and very few Europeans either.
What are the broad structures of that? Because, one of the things, I feel like it is analogous, but not nearly, obviously, the dynamic is very different. But in New York State, for instance, over the course of the past 10 years, we've had a closure of nearly 20% of the public hospitals. We've seen a diminution of resources to those hospitals, and we can track the deaths of people in that big, in March, April, May, in New York. And we can see that aligns with where resources have been distributed or not. And there's obviously a huge economic and class component to both deaths and contractions within the context of New York State anyways. And so there's a slight analogy, right? I mean, obviously you set a context, but how does this extraction, I guess maybe you tell me if it's best sort of exemplified by the fact that, a complete absence of, or not complete, but an absence of latex gloves in a place that you couldn't have more latex, really, when we talk about West Africa.
Well, the thing that probably rolled out the red carpet for Ebola in that part of West Africa, which, as some people call Upper West Africa, is probably war, civil war, right? But the wars were fought over the extractive trades. That's why they call them blood diamonds, the diamonds from Sierra Leone. And, Liberia is the, used to be the United States, really, latex plantation. And that was Firestone that set that up almost 100 years ago with a famous 99-year-long lease of something like 1 million acres. I mean, this is a huge endeavor. And so there are the ironies, right? Here we're getting diamonds that are blooded. And here in a place where there's so much latex, you could swim in it. The nurses and doctors called to respond to Ebola don't even have latex gloves. But, looking back at the history, first of all, just to, stick with the example of Liberia, which is, the oldest independent republic in on the continent by many accounts. And it was founded by Americans, black Americans, at least its coastal reaches. By the time I had set foot in Liberia, some people estimated that there were fewer than 50 practicing physicians, clinically active physicians in the country. And, just doing the math, you could say, well, that would be like having 6 doctors in the city of Boston. And, I can't walk 5 feet in the Brigham and Women's Hospital and not bump into 5 of my colleagues who are physicians. You know, it's just crazy, this disparity. So then you start looking back and saying, well, what about training nurses and doctors in this part of West Africa? And you find out that in the European colonies of Guinea and Sierra Leone, the French and the British didn't even bother founding a single medical school in those countries. And in fact, in Sierra Leone, the oldest European colony in that part of the world, a British colony, not only was there no medical school founded before they left in 1963, I was alive already, but they didn't found a nursing school either. And they took the trouble in 1902 to ban black doctors from the colonial medical service. So those are the kind of details that make a big difference down the line when you start talking about where is the staff, the stuff, the space and systems to respond to, you know, Ebola, without even talking about out-migration of professionals like experienced nurses to the UK, the United States, other places where they end up. So I thought that was an important part of the history to know, to understand not only why this place is a medical desert, but what we could do to irrigate it. You know, is it some mysterious cultural problem? No, it's, as you said, these are structural problems. And that means they need to be addressed structurally as well.
And ultimately that means for you, reparations, to come in and I guess to build those infrastructures, right? I mean, to irrigate them, I guess, those deserts and create the infrastructures to essentially catch up on some level of those literally hundreds of years that they, missed in developing these type of medical infrastructures.
I'm perfectly comfortable with the term reparations. You know, in my line of work, you know, you need reparative action to train the staff, buy the stuff, you know, develop the clinical spaces and put in place the systems. I mean, some of the systems we're talking about aren't just infection control, which is a systems approach, like, for example, involves PPE, respiratory precautions, contact precautions, the kind of things that are now the subject of public discussion in the United States. But it also means the systems required to pay people regularly. I mean, I met nurses, including a couple who died of Ebola, who hadn't been paid in a year or 2 years. And the answer was always, or the reasons given were always the same, we don't have the resources. And, you know, that's pretty hard to stomach. You know, if you're in the middle of a part of Sierra Leone where, you know, diamond production is happening round the clock just 5 miles away. And so we need to link this extraction, not just that which is going on now, which is pretty substantial, but to understand what it has cost people who live in that part of the world to have been subjected to this steady drumbeat of extraction for so long. I mean, I'd be hard pressed to think of any other place in the world where it's been going on that long and when sustained over that amount of time. As you said, from slaves to gold and diamonds to latex, wood, all the treasures on top of the earth and those just under it. So, yeah, we need reparative action. And, you know, that's going to involve things like building stronger hospital systems, putting proper training in place so that they do have the staff they need, and thinking about what kind of infusions of resources, including capital, are required to build up health systems in that part of the world.
What I think is fascinating about your work is that those lessons obviously apply both, I mean, within those societies to other institutions and other, outside of medicine. I mean, obviously, they're interrelated in terms of like infrastructure in a country just writ large is going to implicate, obviously, health outcomes. But that's also a dynamic that can be applied in other countries. And
well, you know, just to take our own, you know, as you pointed out, we have not only not invested in public health, but we've divested from public health. So any effort to understand the reasons, plural, for which we've done so spectacularly poorly in responding to COVID-19 are going to have to take account of that divestment, right? And, you know, I think most people involved in the press for reparations in the United States, the American descendants of slaves, would not be keen to hear us use the term to describe needed investments in public health, or public education, or public transportation, or public, just public anything. Those discussions are often about, since 40 acres and a mule, are often about the private reparative action to the descendants of those who had been enslaved. And I get that entirely. We also need much, much broader reparative action around the, you know, the safety net of this country, including its public health apparatus. And, you know, the return on our investments in basic science research, every American who's going to get a vaccine should marvel at that. But we've been done very poorly investing in a national health care delivery system that can, you know, be a safety net for everyone. So we need it here as well.
What other, I mean, is that, I mean, obviously those are lessons derived from our response. What else? I mean, I'm curious if in your response to epidemics in the past, you've seen anything analogous to the idea that, you know, obviously the administration has sort of been, like I think you said, nihilistic in terms of containment. But have you ever seen this level of sort of denial? I mean, we have 300,000 Americans dead. We're going to have more than likely and at least 100,000 more before this is over. Have you seen anything that's even remotely analogous to this type of like societal response?
Well, you know, I think part of the reason I would say no, I have not, is because I am an American and I was born here and raised here. And spend much of my time as a doctor and a teacher here. Of course, that's my day job. So part of this affective, you know, component of it is that it's striking so close to home. And that's when compared to other pandemics that we've seen, for example, cholera. I've been in the thick of not one cholera pandemic, but two. And, you know, the United States wasn't spared entirely when the largest one until very recently erupted in Haiti, right? Of course, cases ended up in Florida and Texas and other border states, but it's not like it became out of control anywhere. I you know, the closest to that for me would be HIV, which came along when I was just beginning my medical studies. So, you know, there's another affective component. When I was doing my medical school rotations, my clinical rotations, AIDS was far and away the leading killer of young adults in this country. So our teaching hospitals in Boston were full of people who were dying of AIDS, but I also got to see them stop dying of AIDS when we developed new tools to treat them. But this experience has really been, for me, unprecedented, you know, to see such a rich, and an egalitarian country as ours do so poorly. And of course, part of the reason is because of the inegalitarian nature of our country. Another is the divestment from public health. And another is the nature of our public health system, which is very patchwork, like our political system, like our administrative systems. Whereas in Rwanda, the only place I've spent a significant amount of time during the COVID epidemic, their response was so much better and was reflected in very small numbers of cases and even and really tiny numbers of deaths. And that was in part because they did have a national program, not just a national COVID response program, but a national healthcare delivery system that could provide standardized services, including preventive services that will be relevant even more with a vaccine, but also contact tracing. I have little doubt that at one point in this epidemic, Rwanda, which has 12 million population, had as many contact tracers as we did in the entire United States.
Wow.
You know, it's just we have been slow on the uptake with a lot of reasons. And again, that gets us back to the leadership question.
And those structural forces. I mean, we just don't have the pipes in some way to fill, you know, to send out what we need to send out, whether that's, healthcare or even resources to get people to behave in such a way that they protect themselves. We don't have any of that infrastructure.
And you know that from your own work in the media, how splintered that is. But it's you can see the analogies, you know, across the board. And, you know, that's cost us a lot. But I would add that, you know, if you look at the stimulus bills or the COVID response bills that have managed to wend their way through Congress, and they're very few in number, very little of that money went to public health.
Right.
So, again, that seems like really a bad idea in the middle of a public health crisis to skip over investments in public health. And so we still need to do that. Now we're going to have to, print money. Governments can do that. But we're going to have to do something to get those resources into the public health system and the safety net.
Hope Springs Eternal, Dr. Paul Farmer, Fever, Feuds, and Diamonds, Ebola, and the Ravages of History. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. It's a real pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Okay, folks, the other big story that we have today, of course, not only Joe Biden winning the Electoral College, I guess.
Winning again. Keeps winning.
So much winning. But that is also the resignation of Bill Barr, who is resigning with, I guess, a month left in his potential tenure. I don't think he would be reappointed by Joe Biden.
That washes the blood off his hands.
Well, I mean, that is the thing that I think is like, you know, I hope that we are not going to see this guy on some type of reformation tour, and that people are going to remember that the idea that he, you know, was pushed out with 30 days left is not some, and, you know, I this is one of those few times where I think I agree with what is being said on Fox. Here's Brian Kilmeade this morning on Fox and Friends. And I think this is important to keep in mind.
So that was a bit of a surprise yesterday as that news came out that A.G. Barr was resigning. Then you thought, OK, here comes the slings and arrows and the resignation letter, which doesn't mention the president. Absolutely wrong. They had a good meeting. He's only getting out 3 weeks early. He says after Christmas, I'm just going to call it a day. And I just think when it's all said and done and when many books are written about the fair book is written about the Trump administration, you'll turn out that he is the MVP. He came in at the exact right time to so-called land the plane after the Mueller investigation. And I think by coming out and saying what he saw and say right now, I didn't say there weren't any problems. I said there weren't widespread problems to overturn an election. Mm. And when it comes to an investigation, the Department of Justice rules clearly say you're not supposed to reveal what's as someone's being investigated because forever they're going to be tarred if they don't, if they decide there was nothing there and they decide not to go further.
Well, I mean, they did ultimately reveal that, that Hunter Biden was being investigated. But I think what he was looking for is you're not supposed to interfere with an election by revealing that an investigation is happening. But I will say this. I do hope that Bill Barr is considered the MVP of the Donald Trump administration so that people don't forget who this guy is. There was too many folks who are high placed in the legal profession who basically said, we can trust Bill Barr. He is, he's old school Republican. I think to a certain extent, he probably was. And people should learn that lesson that that's your old school Republican.
Well, certainly. And by the way, Kilmeade is citing a Wall Street Journal report that Barr chose not to investigate or chose not to take a hands-off approach to any Hunter Biden thing, which I find a little dubious. Apparently it was one source. I don't know. But I do want people to remember Bill Barr as the MVP of the Trump administration because he was certainly the MVP of authoritarianism, of the trend towards fascism that Trump wanted to do. He was a good soldier. He politicized the Justice Department in a way we haven't seen since Watergate, and definitely worse than that. And that is how he should be remembered, because we're seeing the rehabilitation of people like Mattis, other Lewandowski even is on cable news, other folks who were intimately involved in the Trump administration who deserve the blame for being in those circles just as much as others.
And of course, he had a big piece in Lafayette Square in those protests over the summer. That's it for us today, folks. We will see you tomorrow. Unless, of course, you are sticking around, in which case we'll see you right now. Just a reminder, you can join us in the fun half. You know, we have a whole box of swag over there that we got to start wearing, at one point.
On air?
Well, right now would be a great time to I'll set this up tomorrow where, you would show it off maybe like the cap, like the Majority Report cap, or I would have a series of carpenter pencils or
there
maybe some stickers. You know what? There's no hoodie, but there's a bunch of t-shirts.
Oh, okay. Well, that I'm cold, so I was hoping for.
I know it's a little bit cold in here.
We have the window open.
We got the window open. Yeah. I got our CO2 levels down to like less than 450. I think
Sam
at this point.
Sam is super proud of the CO2 levels.
Oh yeah.
Measure that? Can you measure that? Is that a thing?
There is a.
He does it every day.
I have a measuring device because I want.
I was wondering how you guys were doing this. I didn't even know you were in the same room. This is.
Oh yeah. Well, there's
this is a business.
Big plastic thing between us here, more or less, really a clear shower curtain. And then we got multiple filters, sort of over there. At one point we'll do a thing. Maybe like when we were able to take it down, when we've both been vaccinated and, fumigated and whatnot. But, just a reminder. Well, I mean, Nomi, you'll be able to, deliver a reminder on your show, but, folks, you can support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and then you get extra content, every single day, more often than not. I mean, almost always. Let's put it that way. And, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. If you want some of that merch that we've been talking about, everybody's talking about it. Everybody is talking about it. shop.majorityreportradio.com. Check it out. Also, and as always, subscribe. My daughter called me 5 minutes before the end of the show today. I mean, excuse me, 5 minutes before the start of the show. I'm like, sweetie, what's up? Is it an emergency? Because she knows not to call me now. You know, at that time, it's panic. She goes, you need to know that you are 8,000 people away from reaching 1 million YouTube subscribers.
Wow. Wait, is that closer than we were yesterday?
I think by maybe 50 people, maybe. I don't know.
Hey, not bad.
I don't know. So subscribe. Let's see if we can just nail this thing.
For your daughter.
Yes.
She's like, so I need to go to college. Please subscribe.
She's just excited because that's in her... You know, with 15-year-olds.
YouTube subscribers.
YouTube subscribers is she's like, you have 1 million YouTube subscribers. And I'm like, you know what? It doesn't really feel that different from when we had 50.
Yeah.
50 YouTube subscribers. And she's like, Dad, it's huge. You don't know how big this is. And I'm like, it's not quite like the.
It's not like you're an influencer doing makeup or something like
honestly,
that.
Honestly, that's when you really have she used to watch this, I can't remember the name of it, but this woman who had a comedy thing. She put lipstick all over her face like this and then talk in a really annoying way. That was her big thing. And now my son watches extreme hide and seek games.
Oh my God, what?
No, this is the generation. They're super.
Yeah, he watches a show.
What about
Unnameables or something like that? And it's just these guys, these 20-year-old guys who do stuff we got a trampoline in the house today. We're just going to bounce on it and do funny stuff. Or then we're going to play extreme. Yeah.
I told you we should do that for Majority Report and you laughed at it.
I know. I know. We really missed out there.
All right. But with all that said, subscribe. Maybe we will do a little trampoline work at one point when this is when we're in, who knows?
Absolutely.
After COVID, it's all bets are off with this channel. That's what I'm telling you that right now. So you subscribe to what you think is a political news program, and then all of a sudden it's going to be extreme hide and seek. Nomi, who's on your show today?
Today we have Aaron Bastani from Navarro Media out in the UK to talk about Brexit, because you know that's still a piece of drama that's happening right now.
And
are we having a technical difficulty?
Yeah, your audio is great, but your video is a little bit slow right now. At least to me, I don't know if that is for
everybody. Yeah, I think so.
It's on my end too. Let me see if I can fix that. I might have to be right back, guys.
All right. And in the meantime, check out The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada. And they've got a Twitch channel. What is it? Twitch.com/TheAntifada?
Twitch.tv/TheAntifada.
They're still in soft launch. Matt, what's happening on your many projects?
Tonight, the Left Reckoning YouTube channel, there's going to be a David Griscom stream at 6 Eastern time.
And we will have Nomi will be back with us in just a moment. But was she able to today at it's going to be Aaron Bastani, Joshua Kahn Russell, and Napoleon Da Legend. Check it out. YouTube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. And we will be back in just a moment. 646-257-3920. We'll take some IMs and we may get some calls. All right. See you soon.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.